You're talking about the Shah's and Shah's.
Yes, so the Shah's, the point that he was trying to drive home, he said, was that Afghanistan was directly in the line of Soviet advance and ambitions, and with that was the organization of an independent People's Republic of some kind of Baluchistan, which would run from southern Afghanistan down the corridor along the Turkish-Pakistan frontier, where the Baluchis inhabit both sides, to the Indian Ocean, and thus, at that stage of the game, the Soviet Union would have direct access to the warm waters of the Indian Ocean through a client state. So his fear was that on the one hand, the Iraqis would attack, and on the other hand, he did not fear overt Soviet aggression against Iran, that is, organized military forces attacking in the traditional World War I, World War II way from the Soviet Union. But he did fear organized attack on his other flank by the client states that were more or less puppets of the Soviet Union at some future time. I had told him and expressed myself quite forcefully that I thought he was making a mistake to acquire so much sophisticated, highly technical military equipment because he didn't have the trained people to utilize it. And I pointed out to him that with the highly sophisticated and electronically controlled mechanisms of much of this equipment, if you just put it in the barn, it disintegrated in 3 or 4 months. It has to be constantly used or maintained to be operationally fit for combat or indeed just for maneuver use.
What was his response to that?
And his response was he understood that, agreed with me, but he was taking steps to rectify this situation, and our MAG, of course, was expanded a bit when I was there, and then he was hiring people from private some of our big electronic companies that furnished the equipment to give some training of one kind or another to his people. But the net result was that he really didn't. He was not on top of that aspect of the business. And part of that probably comes from the fact that when he raised this question with his military people, they probably all said, yes, yes, boss, because they were all afraid to say anything else or for fear they'd get fired. And it wasn't going the way that he thought it was going or the way that he had instructed it to go.
I have some questions. We'll get back to that again, but I have some questions about some of the policymakers in Washington.
Yeah.
When you were 69 and 70 and 71 and so forth, how much interest did Secretary of State Rogers have in Iranian issues? Did you recall?
Well, I think he had very, very great, you say Secretary Rogers, of course, the instructions all are signed to the Secretary of State's name, but Near Eastern Division, that was run by Joe Sisko then, was the focal point of the formulation and development of policy.
Sure.
But I think from the White House on down, I know for a fact that there was great preoccupation and concern with the situation in that part of the world for a very simple reason. United States security policy rests on the concept of a security tripod. The tripod, the legs of the tripod, are based in North America, Canada, the U.S., Japan and the Pacific, and NATO, Europe. Two legs of that tripod were extremely vulnerable at that stage of the game to what happened in the Persian Gulf. Because if something went wrong and the oil resources of the Persian Gulf fell into the hands of a power which decided to use those resources as a method of political persuasion. Western Europe, which at that time was about 65% dependent for its energy on the Persian Gulf, and Japan, which was very heavily dependent also. If somebody said, sorry, no oil unless you do this or unless you agree not to do that, their choice was to see the wheels of their industry grind to a halt and the lights of their cities go out, or reach an accommodation. And I talked to Joseph Lenz, who came down there on a trip, and I talked about just before he became NATO Secretary General, he came down as Dutch Foreign Minister, and I had a long, long meeting with him at the Dutch Embassy at his request. I'd known Joseph Lenz for many years from the time I worked with Eisenhower at Shape. He was Foreign Minister and the like. And I said to him, what would happen if Western Europe were faced with a business, either you cease and desist or don't do this or accept that, or no, or you get no energy? And he said, well, I fear that Western Europe would have no choice but to reach some form of an accommodation, because the alternative would be a total collapse of its economy and its national life. Mm-hmm. So one would hope that that would never happen, but it is a very important thing. And I mention all this only because nobody, the President Nixon and Secretary Rogers and the department, both with respect to not just the Near Eastern Division, but EUR, the European Division, and the Far Eastern Division, knew exactly what would happen to their clients or the people for whom they had policy formulation responsibilities if the Persian Gulf fell into the hands of a power, as I say, that or a regime or regimes that decided to use oil as an element, energy as an element of political persuasion.
In terms of formulating policy and strategy and tactics, does the State Department have a major role, or the Kissinger and his staff, are they taking more of a role in these matters? Or
well, we had a most unfortunate situation in that period of time. Kissinger, because of his ambitions, he's a very clever man, but he was a very ambitious man. He tried to keep control of everything in the National Security Council and under his own control. And on one occasion, when he was off shuttling around in the Middle East and playing around in Europe, and an urgent matter required action, the State Department was unable to get any action at the White House because Kissinger had left instructions that it should not go to the President. Nothing should go on this matter until he returned. Well, that matter was dealt with before he returned, and the proper answer was given. But I mention that because Mr. Kissinger himself was the first to recognize how awkward this situation was, because when he became Secretary of State, he immediately arranged for the abolishment of the NSC so that nobody could do to him what he had done to the Secretary of State.
So that would pose problems from time to time, that relationship, I guess.
Well, Mr. Kissinger, as NSC guy, controlled the papers that came from the State Department and went up to the President. And so if he wanted to hold something up, he was in a position to do it in the White House. Unless the Secretary went directly to the President, which he did on the occasion which I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet with Kissinger, discuss Iranian issues? Or
no.
No. Now, before your appointment to Iran, Nixon had made a speech at Guam on the Nixon Doctrine. When you became ambassador, was this speech considered, did you consider that speech to be relevant to your efforts, the Nixon Doctrine approach? Is that something that was talked about among policymakers?
I don't remember that.
Yeah. You know, the idea that third world countries would be given U.S. support, military aid, and so forth. Was that was a reflection of?
Yeah. Insofar as Iran is concerned, the action with respect to Iran and other countries had preceded the Nixon doctrine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so perhaps it was an enunciation, more of a public enunciation of what we've been doing in individual cases rather than...
Yeah.
The Nixon doctrine didn't startle me or ring any sudden bells because, I mean, this is precisely what had been we had been assisting countries that we felt were vulnerable to put themselves in a position to maintain their independence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. When you first arrived in Tehran, what were your impressions of Iran back in 69 as you...
I've been to Iran before on one occasion going through on my day. My impressions were of a country that was still deep in a feudal mentality that had emerged or was emerging with a superficial Western patina, but that it had a long road to go. I think, for example, before I ever thought I was going to Iran, I think I was in Austria or someplace. Maybe it was Belgium. I knew the Iranian ambassador, member of the diplomatic corps, a pleasant fellow. And one day I was talking with him, and he was complaining bitterly about the land reform of 63, about how, you know, they were taking all the land away. And I said, well, how much land did you lose? Expecting an answer, you know, 70,000 or 10,000 hectares or acres or something. And he said to me, I can't remember if it was 37 or 39 villages. Villages. By that he meant he had lost that under the system that was there before the Shah's land reform, the absentee landlord owned every tree, brick, stick, and indeed had a feudal control over villages and what they produced and the income that they brought to him and the like. And this was just several short years before I went to Iran. When you have a mentality of an intelligent man, educated man, that he was complaining because they had taken away, he couldn't remember if it was 37 or 39 villages, it says something about the outlook of the so-called upper classes. And the masses, the peasantry, were very much seen in Egypt in the 30s, in the early 30s, when I was out in Egypt on a trip up country at Dit. And there also, I remember a Prince Latfa at that time, under British control, but it was a feudal, it was totally feudal. And I was invited up to Easter up the river near Aswan, and I went out riding with him, and we rode through several villages, one about 15,000, one about 10,000, and everybody bowed to him and everything else. And he said, these are two of the five villages that belong to me. Well, I mean, it was the same sort of feudal mentality. I'd like to say a word, if I may, about the Shah.
That's the next question.
The Shah was a remarkable man. I'm no psychiatrist, but I think he probably had his whole background and upbringing had left him with complexes of various kinds. He had no formal education at the university level. He had gone to an excellent school in Switzerland, the Rose School. He spoke foreign languages. He spoke English and French fluently. But he had no formal language. And then suddenly, at about the age of 20, after World War II broke out, and after Russia was attacked. You recall that the British and the Russians moved into Iran. Why did they move into Iran? Because Iran, under the Shah's father, was just as much concerned after the attempt to dismember it in Azerbaijan in 1946, despite the pledge at the Tehran conference that the troops would be withdrawn, the occupying troops. And Iran, as a counterweight to the pressures and ambitions of the Russians, had always flirted with the Germans, including the Hitler government. So when Russia came into the war, the British and the Russians decided that this was an undependable country, that it had flirtations with Mr. Hitler, just indeed as Stalin and Molotov did in the Molotov-Ribbentrop Agreement, but for quite different reasons, and they occupied it. Now, at the same time they occupied it, they took the Shah's father, a man of considerably strong leadership qualities and a rather dominant man, and they exiled him to an island off in the Indian Ocean somewhere. And they put this 21-year-old boy on the throne, the Shah, in a country that was totally divided with a line of demarcation, where our people delivering lend-lease were not allowed to cross the line of demarcation across the middle of Iran into northern Iran that the Russians occupied. But they had to deliver the stuff there. They were allowed no further. And the British in the southern half. And so he was sort of nothing more than a figurehead put in to replace his father and have a nominal business. But every single activity was dominated by, in the southern half, by the British government, and in the northern half, by the Russians. And the Shah had, as I say, had no formal education in the university sense. Knew nothing about economics. And he was a puppet. And then the war finally ended, and he went out. And finally, because of the very strong position President Truman took, the Russians withdrew from Azerbaijan, as they had committed themselves and then violated that commitment. The Shah was left in charge. And I don't think he was in any way, at that time, equipped to deal with what he had to deal with. And the result, of course, was the emergence of Mr. Mossadegh, who was a brilliant and rather curial man with a lot of charisma, and the Shah was almost nothing, and then thought he was worried, and he left, as you remember, and then he was returned, and Mossadegh was overthrown, and he was put back in power. I don't know whether this experience gave him an inferiority complex, or his father, or not, because I'm not a psychiatrist. But I do know that he told me, one of our early meetings, he was describing to me what he was trying to do and what he had done. He said, you probably wonder, Mr. Ambassador, why I call my revolution, which is to try to give the people a better way of life, and to modernize Japan and bring it into the modern world, a white revolution. He said, because after the Mossadegh experience, I realized that if there were not reforms in this country, social reforms, education, political reforms, and the like, that then there would be a red revolution. It would be red in terms of the blood that would run in the streets, but it would be red also because it would be led by the Tudor Party, which Moscow controls. And that is why, with my white revolution of land reform, universal education, secularization of the education system, which the Mullahs never forgave him for, never forgave him for taking the formation of the children out of their hands and molding them into their particular brand of Shiite Islam. together with the taking away of their lands, although there was an ex gratia payment of $115 to $120 million a year for the revenue that they lost from it. But the Shah was trying, obviously, to follow the Japanese model, and in less than 40 years, bring his country from total feudalism into a modern state that could compete industrially and economically. His motives were good, but his knowledge and abilities of how to go about it were extremely limited. And then, because of his success in the first, in getting back from Mossadegh, and then in the struggle with the clergy in 61, 62, and 63, he became arrogant to the extent that he thought that he knew best. And if you disagreed with him, you were replaced and somebody else was put in as a minister. And the result was that by the time I got there, he was surrounded by a cabinet of men who said yes, no matter, who were supposed to be technically trained and able to do certain things, but who said yes to everything he said, whether it was obviously going to result in a disaster.
Did any of the officials have any real influence with them, or was it pretty much across the board like you
thought? The only official whom I knew, well, let me put it this way. None of the economic ministers, the economic minister when I got there was a very able fellow. He had a doctorate in economics from the Sorbonne in Paris, and was a very, wanted as much as anybody to bring his country out of feudalism into the modern world. But he had been in office less than a year and a half, 2 years, something like that, maybe a year and a half, I don't know. When the Shah decided he wanted to do something, and he made the point rather strongly that that would be a disaster because it would result in this and this and this and this, which would be just the opposite of what they were trying to achieve. He was relieved within 24 hours and a new man was put in who said yes, yes. So one of the things that he ended up, one of the things that destroyed him was he ended up by having people around him who, instead of counseling him and saying, "No, Your Majesty, this is a better way for these reasons," and listening to those people, he ended up with nothing but a mirror of himself in his cabinet. And there was only one man that I knew that I could be sure would get a message in the form and the spirit that I meant it to him, and that was Alam. But Alam, although I did not know it, had cancer, and before I left was very, very, very ill. He was the only one that I could be sure would present something to the Shah if it was something that he didn't, that our government wanted to, or some observation that I had to make that was not in keeping with his thoughts, that would do it in the spirit and in the form that it had been put. The others, if you did it, you never knew how it would be twisted one way or another, perhaps to make them look good.
What was the social basis for the Shah support in Iran? What social groups did actually give him positive support?
You see, the thing that is so misunderstood about Iran is that when I went to Iran in 69, with the exception of the clergy, he had support from all social groups. Why? For a very good reason. Since his white revolution in 63, everybody's life had gotten better. Everybody had more. It's true, the rich got rich very, very quickly, and the poor got better off very slowly. But everybody was better off. And so there was universal support. And in 1970, when the first indication that terrorists were prepared to be active came when a commando of terrorists, when I was coming down from a dinner on the night of November 30th, 1970, from a dinner with Alam and with my wife, Mrs. Alam, and the Minister of Economic or Financial Affairs and his wife. After dinner that night, a car cruised up alongside with four young men in it swerving, and it was the night before a holiday, and they frequently drank before a holiday. I said to the driver, be careful, because I think those young men have perhaps been drinking and seem to be rather driving recklessly. Suddenly the car slammed into the front of my car, the Embassy Cadillac. I still thought it was an accident the way they were weaving around until the door opened and I saw the automatic weapons, and having had some CIC training before in Normandy and during the battle, before up through the Battle of the Bulge and one thing or another, I knew what was coming next, and they had made the hit rather badly. They hadn't gotten completely across the front of the car, and the Cadillac had a lot of power, and the little chauffeur had not, the Iranian chauffeur had not killed the engine, and so I screamed go and threw my wife and myself into the bottom of the car, and these boys opened fire. We brushed the car aside, they shot the windows out of the car. One of them had an axe, obviously, to attack the window if I tried to lock myself in. They threw the axe, hit me in the arm, I had it in the other room. Mounted, it was given to me later by the police. I mention this because of that commando of a total of 10 people. Oh, incidentally, while the car hit us in front, another car came up behind, of course, so it couldn't back out. And it was a usual form of hit. The same commando, a week later, assassinated an Italian, an Iranian general when he was taking it in the morning. He was on his way to taking his boy to school, dropping him off at school before going on to his duties in the Ministry of Defense. Now, why do I mention this? Because when this happened, the Shah's radio, the government radio, went on the air for a week or so, saying that there were subversive revolutionaries that were being infiltrated into Iran that were determined to destroy all the good that had been accomplished by the white revolution, and that if anybody in the countryside or in the cities saw any strange people around in groups or one thing or another, they should let the police know. In the following 12 months, 375 people were rounded up, not because of the cleverness of Savak. In every case, simple people called up and said, there are some of these people that look suspicious. The police came from there. In the case of my commando, it's a bit more dramatic, because four of these people took refuge, or five, in a house in the poorest slums of Tehran as a base to operate from. But they were new to this poor slumish area. They kept to themselves. They were not friendly. They didn't like the kids in the street poking their noses and looking in their windows or anything. And so some of these people said, well, maybe these are terrorists or somebody. So they called the police. These poor slummers, the inhabitants of the slums. The police came, thinking it was just another call, you know. They opened the door, the guy saw them and pulled out his gun and shot two of the policemen dead. They besieged it. They killed three of them and captured one who was wounded and so forth. That commando of 10, I think six are dead and four are heroes of the revolution or vice versa. But I make the point that when this happened in 69, there was no question of the Shah not having the support of the Bazari. They were better off than they had been in years. The wealthy class were better off because they had transferred, their lands had been taken, but they had been paid, and they had invested in a lot of this new industry that the government was supporting, that was paying them off, and the people were better off. And this, in effect, is the logical lead-in to the terrible mistake that the Shah made that destroyed, that was as much responsible, I think, as almost anything else in his destruction.
Now, this is when you, after you were ambassador,
This was after I had retired from ambassador.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Would you like me to develop that?
If you, yeah, sure, yeah.
I left in 1972 and took up, I had been in government then 39 years and altogether, and I decided that I'd have a second career lecturing and being a consultant on international affairs for business and institutions. But I used to go back to Iran after letting 15 months go by, which is what all ambassadors do because of a career. You don't go back, interfere with the new ambassador who's there making his own place. But after that, I went back at least once and sometimes twice a year. In every case, I would let the Shah know as he had asked me to. And in every single case when I got there, I was told that he would receive me and I'd go up and spend two and a half hours with him. He wanted to talk about a lot of things. And this leads me to the great mistake he made. I was not present when he made the mistake. The mistake that contributed as much to his downfall as anything was at the end of 1973 and 1974, when the price of oil went up four times to astronomical figures, the Shah took a $31 billion five-year plan that was about 5 or 6 months down the pipe, industrial development plan. That plan, $31 billion, stretched the infrastructure, both human and physical, of Iran beyond its limits. But he might have been able to accomplish 80% of the plan. He took that $31 billion plan and made it into a $67 billion plan. And what happened? The obvious. With all this money floating around, inflation went through the roof. And the masses of the urban poor, swollen by massive immigration of millions of illiterate people from the villages over the past 7 or 8 years before that. When I left Tehran, it was growing at 250,000 people a year. A quarter of a million a year it was growing at. The illiterates came down from the villages where they had eked out a subsistence existence in the little land that was they could cultivate, that was arable, that they could bring under cultivation with water, the sources available from the springs that were there. They had swollen the masses of the urban poor. The Shah found work for them. He had the equivalent of sort of a WPA like we had under the Roosevelt administration, and they did a lot of construction and road building. But when inflation went up to 45-50% and over, the masses of the urban poor suddenly were infinitely worse off than they'd been in the villages. So they alienated. Secondly, with all this money sloshing around, corruption became visible. Members of the family, people close to the Shah, were shaking down foreign businessmen who were trying to get a piece of this $67 billion like mad. And they were getting, it was so visible that the ordinary guy in the street could see it. So this also undermined it. Now, this situation went on for about a year and a half or so until he realized that he had to do something about it because things were getting out of hand. And so then he decided to put a freeze, less 10% on all prices, increase the wages of the working masses by 40% plus, and thus regain their confidence and get the thing under control. But all that happened was that the bazaari, the middle class, which a regime like the Shah's had to depend on more than any other group or class, they suddenly found themselves squeezed. they were told, with prices going up, inflation up to 55-60% by that time, they were told prices less 10% and increased wages 40%, and they felt squeezed, and 250,000 of them were fined or disciplined. Some went to jail for 3 or 4 weeks and the like, and the middle class was alienated. So you had first the masses of the urban poor, then the middle class, and then this situation went along for a year or two, and then he decided nothing, it was getting worse, so he called in Jamshid Amuzegar to deflate, former finance minister. And Jamshid mounted a deflationary program, which was making progress. But one of the first things that he cut was the ex gratia payment that the Shah had made to the clergy over, since the lands were taken away, of about 115 to 120 million. So the clergy, basically and fundamentally alienated since the White Revolution, that gave women equal rights, that did away with the veil at Chabal, that took the education, the formation of the minds of the youths out of their hands and secularized it. On top of that, this. And so, by this series of economic decisions, like a great tragedy, one leading to another, leading to another, the three great sectors, national sectors of the national life, the masses of the urban poor, the middle class, and the clergy, which in all the Islamic world occupies an unusually powerful place in Iran, were alienated and driven together with only one thing in common: get rid of the Shah. Everything else they had in common, they had nothing in common.